Blog Talk Radio.
Companion. I'm your host, Dale Graham. It's a pleasure to have you here. And thank you for all of the support. It's just been overwhelming. And for you, I don't know whether there's such a thing as internationals in Freemasonry. So for brethren, whether you're from any of the continents, all of the continents, it's a pleasure. We're going to try and make things interesting and informative and have a talk. And hopefully it'll be the kind of talk that may not be as easy to initiate around the lodge for a lot of reasons. It's not necessarily a shortcoming. It's just the texture and the texture and character of lodges and the work of a lodge may always not be conducive to sitting back, putting your hands behind your head and your feet up. And so wrap your hands around a glass of your favorite. So I'm sitting here with a nice espresso. This is the 46th day of the year, 2014, hereabouts. And I look out and there's a beautiful, beautiful mounds of snow all over this part of Canada, so I'm just enjoying it. Not that this is unique, you know. Did you notice, I'm going to give you some interesting, I think we have some interesting things to talk about on the program today. I hope you agree. At the end of it, you'll tell me by whether you listen in or fade in the background. So I hope it's interesting. We're going to get into a little more of on mnemonics, mnemonic techniques for Freemasons, and then I was going to play a little Rachmaninoff today, but that got pushed aside for something I think is a piece of music that just reminded me, took my breath away. Now, I've been always impressed with this audience. And when I put out these ideas, I'll look forward to hearing your advice, your wisdom on them. Yeah, I have some interesting little facts here. I want you to work into, you know, around the table when you're sitting there with the young wags and the geniuses. I'm going to give you a little bit of information here that will up the ante a bit. Some fun facts. Did you know that Google was originally called Backrub? Did you know that? Oh, neither did I. Did you know that human taste buds are regenerated every 10 days? Yeah. Did you know that the Soviet Union published a children's book of Stalin's 5-year plan? Ooh, ouch. That's a country in earnest, isn't it? Yeah. Did you know that on Neptune, winds can blow at 1,600 miles per hour, the very fastest in the solar system? So when you think about Neptune, think about that, 1,600 miles an hour. Things get really dodgy for us when our winds are getting up to 200 miles an hour here. I think some tornadoes or hurricanes are finding that velocity. Interesting times we're in. Here's a little bit of something for you know, the older I get, the more I'm sort of inclined to appreciate the French Republican, you know, the person that wanted government accountable and the monarch accountable to him. And I like government accountable to me, and I don't want to be government, but I expect that government is of the people. Anyway, frog's legs may turn out to be a British rather than a French delicacy. For people that, you know, this may be the new battle zone, the battlefield between French and English may have reached the dinner table. Frog's legs. Archaeologists working near Stonehenge have uncovered evidence suggesting ancient Britons were eating them about 8,000 years before the French. I didn't know that. I didn't know that 35% of Russia's riches are in the hands of 110 people. I didn't know that. And I didn't know that before the Renaissance, 3/4 of all the books produced in the world were Chinese. We have a great deal of a debt to the ancient cultures, ancient civilizations, and without that, you know. And what changed that? Printing press? Yeah. You know, printing press. There you go. We have, we'll get into some interesting and lively conversation today. Not everybody always wants to have this kind of a conversation. So if you can bring back a Masonic companion when it's suitable to you and your needs, that's perfect. As Nelson Mandela once said, a good head and a good heart are always a formidable combination. So I'll rely on that. A little bit of inspiration today from William Arthur Ward. The pessimist complains about the wind. The optimist expects it to change, and the realist adjusts the sails. There. I think that works. By three methods we may learn wisdom, according to Confucius. First, by reflection, which is noblest. Take a look at ourselves. Think. Second is by imitation, which is easiest. And third, by experience, which is the bitterest. Makes some sense there, eh? Experience is not what happens to you, according to Aldous Huxley. It's what you do with what happens to you. One of my favorites. So we'll get back to the theme of the day, eh? It's we wanted to talk today about the introduction to today's program is Masonics and Mystery, Respect for Obscurity. You know, I've been thinking that a great deal, realizing a great deal of Freemasonry is obscure. We don't have a codex. We just don't pull it up off the shelf and read and understand it. It's not like the text. It's not like scripture. And then even that is prone to discussion and interpretation if it's to be understood. On one hand, you have the people looking for deeper esoteric meaning, and on the other, perhaps people looking for the salve, the calmness of a literal translation. When people are feeling quite anxious, we don't want to. It's very difficult for many people to think philosophically. For others who have that inclination, it's a natural kind of phenomena. They see things in philosophical context. It's hard to say that Freemasonry, I think Freemasonry draws the contemplative, introspective nature of a man to the surface. I do. But I think it's also fundamentally important that we've had this separation or evolution from operative to speculative Freemasons. I think today that the operative is part of that group, in my mind, that is the administration and the worker bees, the literalists. Operative. They don't need to speculate on the nature of the tools. They need to be able to work with the tools. So for them, if there's fellows that are very literal, I dress up, therefore I am. Okay, that's perfect. I go through the ritual, therefore I am. That is not to say that defines everything about Freemasonry, but it's also not necessarily a value judgment that it defines a population of Masons. We're working always out of this notion of obscurity. So I wanted to do a program about this, or at least keep this in mind as you're moving forward. And I'll start with a little bit of stick here, okay? I'll start with that. And then we're going to, perhaps it is subversive. Perhaps it is foolish, attempting to reconfigure Masonry into a marketable commodity. Sell it. 500 years of history is hard to ignore, but that is what happens when the nature of the Masonic order is exposed to attempts to reconfiguration. This is not without impact. Gratefully, strict observance attempts to reverse this type of trending. The advantage of cultural plurality and greater numbers has pushed our philosophy in many directions. I can't help wonder if philosophical discussion of virtue and merit and morality can exist in parallel with agenda promoting our reverent order in the marketplace. You've heard the discussions. This is the explanation. People don't come out because they have other things to do. I didn't know that the development of insight had any parallel. I never heard that before until I've heard that in the hall in the Masonic halls. Does administration alone now define Freemasonry, and to hell with the landmarks and observation? I apologize for the rough language. When we face a task, many perfectly suitable answers fail because their spokesmen are not as persuasive as others, the others have a weaker solution. So claiming we don't know what to do or how to do it is misleading. We may be our own worst enemy in that regard. Regardless of the skill of a speaker, essential ideas of Freemasonry must never be excised. Obviously, our Grand Lodge, your Grand Lodge, is the protector of Freemasonry. Freemasonry is otherwise vulnerable. Think about it. Why does this large structure that seems ponderous, that seems so deliberate and comparatively slow in everything that it's
doing.
Why did it come into existence? Well, the rationalists in the crowd think about it. There is a reason. It's ponderous for a person who doesn't realize just how much is going on. The organization is like a large mine, a mind. The mind, we know that processes that we thought were cause and effect within the human brain are now processes that are initiated by various portions of the brain working in combinations. That's something organic. We know that because now we have the tools to look at it and measure it, don't we? It's a matter of the tools. It wasn't a matter of the right or wrong. But until we have the right tools to measure, we come up with the best explanations we can to explain the phenomena around us. It takes a considerable amount of piety to think that everything before us was wrong. It was just like us. It is us. What we have, our notions of right and wrong will evolve just as they always have. Validity will evolve. But the principles in which they're based, those are things we need to protect and discuss. So the Grand Lodge is there for a reason. And there's evidence of that. If you look back in our history, and you think about the effects of clandestine Freemasonry, the effects were perhaps what I would consider chaotic, destabilizing. I don't know about the rest of you, but I can't do my best work in a chaotic, unstable environment. I need to be able to control the environment around so it's predictable. That's where I begin to do my best work, and I think you do too. If we are only taught a product of a meager training, then we're going to look for the shortcomings in routine. We'll begin to take things for granted that should be sources of great inspiration. What we're talking about with Freemasonry is the maturation, the development, and I guess the influencing of personality. Who would have thought? Regardless of the skill of a speaker, essential ideas of Freemasonry must never be excised. They have to stay. Obviously, our Grand Lodge is the protector of Freemasonry. Philosophical discussion has its place, as does authority. Respectful debate allows us to explore all sides of a question. The function of Freemasonry requires a respectful blend of those equally important talents, weighing options before deciding. When respectful balance is lacking, we find ourselves struggling and frustrated. It's no place for the lodge hall is no place for stupidity. Even though we have a corner of sheep all braying in unison, it's no place. And you and I know that. To find merit among persuasive people requires validation. How do you validation only comes from objective minds? This attitude is suited so well to Freemasonry, we could do well to give it respect. Virtue could be the common religion. You know, the religion on which all men agree. Validation only comes from objective minds. What do you think? What do you think? To me, that suggests that being rash, when we're thinking emotionally, we're thinking to satisfy a desire, and we are putting at risk a coming up with good or right or proper or objective or valid answers. Because when we are in a state of high emotion and thinking emotionally, what our efforts are to do is not necessarily find truth, but to find a way of satisfying that desire, the desire for revenge, the desire for whatever it is, fill in the blank. I'm saying here is that it's temporary, it's trans, it's vaporous, it's perhaps like trying to hold the sands of time in your hand. It just pours through. So let's start. Keep that in mind. Let's have a go here. Let's have at it. We're coming up to, this is the middle of February. Remember, I'll expect you out in your robes on the 20th of March, 12:57 p.m. for the spring equinox, when you can truly look at yourself in the mirror and claim that you're in balance. Won't that be wonderful? Yeah, of course it will be. I'm going to do something that I haven't done. This is, you know, we're in the third year of Masonic Companion. And a lot of you probably weren't around and may not have been around in the early days. So I've pulled a copy of something off the book, off the shelf, by Tom Standage. And we're going to get into this again because the reaction to it the first time around was just remarkable. It's called The History of the World in Six Glasses. Yeah. And I don't think it's overdoing it to say that it's just a fascinating read. And it's something that may be a little mind tease when you pick up a glass of whatever. So we'll get into a little bit of that today. We'll explore today. I think that's the operative word. I was pulling up something I'd like you to consider is a book to add to your library by Mr. Harry Carr. That's two R's. And it's called The Freemason at Work. And you could find, scanned versions of this. Brother Carr was the past junior grand deacon and the past master and secretary and editor of the Quattuoro Coronati Lodge in London. Yeah. He's an honorary member of a number of lodges, a fellow of the American Lodge of Research and Masonic Research Lodge in Connecticut and Ohio and New York. Paris, Cambridge, Massachusetts, Arts and Crafts Lodge in Illinois, the Grand Lodge of Oran, yeah, Portland, Victoria, BC, Victoria Lodge of Education and Research. So it suggests that his credential suggests that he was a man that people wanted to be around, that he had something to contribute. So, and the foreword to his book is written by Sir Lionel Brett, the past district grand master of Nigeria. Those who hold that good wine needs no bush may feel that a foreword to this book is superfluous. There is some force to this view for the generation of readers who have known Brother Harry Carr in person or by reputation, and grown accustomed to a regular flow of articles under his name. But Masonic books have a way of surviving in lodge bookshelves long after they've gone out of print, and it seems certain that this one will be read, quoted, and discussed by generations who have not had those advantages. A foreword will justify itself if it keeps future generations, if it helps to put Brother Carr in his proper class. The United Grand Lodge of England makes little provision for organized Masonic instruction. Every member receives a copy of the Book of Constitutions, but apart from the annual Prestonian lectures and I recommend that you follow that. There's a lodge over in Toronto that actually brings the Prestonian lecture to this country. By the way, the novice with an inquiring mind will not be content for long with a printed ritual and will demand further information. Ah, probing what is going on and why. What does it say? And then what does it say to the reader, to you? If he consults an individual, he will be fortunate to find a preceptor or other informant as well equipped as all round as Brother Carr. If he turns to a book, there are a number in print which he can profitably study, but he may not always know where to look for an answer to his particular question. The distinguishing feature of Carr's book is that it details questions that are actually exercising brethren over a period of 12 years. So this is a book that I would recommend for you, okay? And I won't bore you with the contents, lengthy, but really wonderful and detailed section on content. So it makes it easy, an easy reference point for people to dash through. So if you know, if you I give you just an example. The questions that come to us at Quattro Coronati deal almost invariably with matters in which there is no Grand Lodge ruling, or on which the printed rituals and the rubrics afford little or no explanation. They fall into two classes: those which ask for the meaning and purpose of a specific item of ritual or procedure, or how and why it arose, and those which describe two different versions of ritual or procedure and ask which is correct. Generally, Brother Carter explains, I believe the historical approach is the most rewarding. Tracing the item in question from its earliest appearance and following its development and changes up to the time when our ritual and procedures were more or less standardized in the early 1800s. When, as often happens, no definite conclusion is possible, this method sets out the information that may lead to a probable answer, and at the very least, it gives the inquirer a wider knowledge and a better understanding of the problems that are involved. Of course, it explains you probe the context of your own question. Because the printed pieces were intended for a worldwide circulation, the answers always try to give a little more than the questioner has asked. So you can see this is a person that's really thinking about what we are about, what is on our minds. Prescient type of fellow, huh? What does the name Quattro Coronati mean? The Latin words mean the four crowned ones and allude to the Christian Church's festival of the four crowned martyrs, which is celebrated on the 8th of November annually. And there are numerous versions of the legend of the Sancta Quattro Coronati, all very much alike. So, the story in brief is that, and I'll just give you the sample and then we'll move on, that in AD 302, four stone carvers and their apprentice were ordered by the emperor Diocletian to carve a statue of Asclepius, which, since they were secretly Christians, they evaded doing. For disobedience to the emperor's command, they were put to death on the 8th of November. During the year 304, Diocletian ordered that all Roman soldiers should burn incense before a statue of the same god. When four who were Christians refused to do so, for which they were beaten to death. This was also said to have been on 8th of November, though 2 years later than the stone carvers. Melchiades, who was Pope from AD 310 to 314, ordained that these two sets of four and five martyrs were to be commemorated on November 8th under the single name of Quattro Coronati. The sacramentary of Pope Gregory 200 years later confirmed that date, and Pope Honorius built a church in their honor in the 7th century. They are to be found to this day depicted in sculpture and painting in many medieval and later churches in Europe. The saints are referred to in the earliest known version of the old charges, the Regius manuscript, which is dated at 1390. And there is good evidence, 14th century, boys and girls, there is good evidence that they were venerated by English masons, notably in an ordinance of the London masons and dated 1481, still preserved in the Guildhall archives, which prescribed that every Freemason of the craft shall attend at Christ Church, Aldgate, on the feast of the Quattro Coronati to hear Mass, under a penalty of 12 pence. The founders of our lodge, 9 in number, of whom 4 were soldiers, chose Quattro Coronati as the name of the lodge, and November 8th has been the date of the annual festival and installation meeting since its foundation. Gives you that warm, comfortable feeling. The next is on the bright morning star. How do I stop this? It's like, you know, eating one potato chip. When we are exhorted in the third degree to lift our eyes to that bright morning star whose rising brings peace and salvation, are we referring to a particular star, or is this pure symbolism? Man, that's interesting. I have my opinion. Particular star. Let's see what Harry says. The various aspects of this problem may be best envisaged perhaps from the following quotations, beginning with some extracts from Miscellanea Latimorum, Series 2, Volume 31. It is argued that this reference to that bright morning star is an allusion to the founder of Christianity, and as such should never have been included in or retained in the ritual of an association professing entire freedom from denominational creed or dogma, outside of the simple basic belief in the existence of a supreme being. This attitude has unfortunately been bolstered up by a frequent misquotation of the wording, the phrase "whose rising brings peace and tranquility" being often rendered as peace and salvation. This is erroneous and decidedly mischievous. As a symbol, the morning star is indeed most appropriate in the ceremonial incident just previously enacted, so apt, in fact, that it may be confidently asserted that no other symbol could be found which would be so perfectly fit to the circumstance of the case. Astronomically, the morning star is the herald of the dawning of a new day, just as its opposite, the evening star, presages the coming of night. The latter foretells the dying of another day, the approach of the time when man can no longer work, when darkness covers the face of the earth. Darkness has ever been associated with evil, and in its somber, unknown possibilities is a fitting emblem of death. On the other hand, the rising morning star brings joy and gladness from its promise of yet another day, of light once more, in which man may work and renew his association with his fellow, man in business or in pleasure. In short, the new-born day, man rises to a new life. What more fitting symbol than this in the promise of new life and the immortality of the soul? Now, I tend to think, and you may want to get back into I went a little bit further back, perhaps, into Egyptology, and my inclination that it is a specific star. It is a specific star, and it is Sirius, S-U-I-R, like the satellite radio system. And what it harbors, and it holds together. Having to do with the course of the changing seasons and the events and what the star indicated. But that's me. You may want to do a little bit of that research yourself and find out. But that's the Freemason Network. And I think it would be worthwhile, just because it's very, very muscular bit of Masonic history. You'd be well versed if you were making mistakes solely based on the work of Harry Carr. Let's say, of course, it's not going to be comprehensive or definitive, but it's pretty darn good. So check it out, you know. Yeah. Here we're going to just, you know, I'm just looking at some famous Freemasons in science and medicine. Edward Jenner, the discoverer of the cure for smallpox, inventor of the concept of vaccination. Man, thank goodness. Joseph Lister, surgeon and scientist, the man who pioneered the concept of antiseptics in medicine. And Alexander Fleming, Scottish bacteriologist, who won the Nobel Prize for his discovery of penicillin, opening the golden door of antibiotic therapy. And Vannevar Bush, the computer pioneer and the man who first envisioned the internet in 1945. Well, you know that a flag with a square and compasses was landed on the moon. Little things, though. You know what we're like. We just like to be places and leave a little, you know, a little something that suggests the ideas of Freemasons, not the man. It's the idea, let's generate this sense that the idea of Freemasonry is with those people. Yeah. As we say. I'm going to turn tide, if I can, turn this ship a little bit, and we're going to look at mnemonic techniques in Freemasonry. You okay? You okay with that? I like it. I thought it was informative. So, central to any, this will help you about the role of memory. It kind of important in Masonic circles, especially with the advances in neurology in the 20th and 21st century. Not to say that's when the concepts were initiated. Some of the concepts in neurology are thousands of years old, but I digress. Central to any basic understanding of Freemasonry is the role of memory. For the lodge itself was a mnemonic of the temple, of a lost ideal, and much else. Esoteric knowledge, too, was not safe in the hands of the ignorant or the profane. So if you don't have patience for ignorant or profane people, whether they're wherever they are, symbolically they would never be inside of a lodge, of course. But tolerance. Esoteric knowledge, too, was not safe in the hands of the ignorant or the profane. So it was safer for initiates to remember such material, possibly using emblems as aids rather than to commit secrets to the page. So it gave, as we do, in a very limited way here in Upper Canada, most lodges are bereft of symbols. And I find that it's simply the fact that the fellows don't know. They have a very sort of tight circle of Masonic experience. Is that to say a lodge enriched in symbol is better? Well, it's producing more information. To my way, yes, because it's like walking through a Masonic library when the walls and the hall itself is adorned with symbols. So we find what? A handful of those symbols? Well, that's a very, very sparse library, I would say. It's not the symbol, it's what the symbol conveys. It's like when I see a lodge that doesn't have the pillars. Again, to me, it's like that laboratory that's not completely equipped. Among the many facets of ancient knowledge to be rediscovered and reinterpreted during the Renaissance period was the method used in classical antiquity for improving memory. Now, remember, just to bring this up a bit, the Renaissance period was wedged in, that was, you know, 1400 to 1600, and it followed what we know as the late or high Middle Ages. You know, this is like, in spite, you know, year 1000 was like the year 2000, you know, everybody's hoarding everything, the world's going to come to an end. Not exactly our finest hour in terms of being able to control superstition, but, you know, that so-called medieval society had evolved. And this is the time when there was a rebirth of interest in ancient Greek and Roman culture and a period of economic prosperity in Europe, especially in Italy and Northern Europe. In art history, there was a study of Italian Renaissance. You want to study the Italian and Northern Renaissance if you're looking at the art. Well, of course we do. We want to understand more about the culture. And the way of looking at the world called humanism was given, you know, took hold. And it's the most basic renewed value on human knowledge and the experience of the world, as opposed to focusing largely on the heavenly realm, using ancient Greek and Roman literature and art as the model. This changed everything. Invention and adoption of the printing press was widely available of books. Now, I'm just going to pop a little tune in here, and we'll come back and we'll pick this up. You'll like this.
Take my hand, I'm a stranger, paradise. Oh, lost in a wonderland, a stranger in paradise. If I stand starry-eyed, that's a danger in paradise. Mortal aside, an angel like I saw her face. There's a chance that she cares. Won't you answer this fervent prayer of a stranger in paradise? Don't send me in dark despair from all that I hunger for. God, don't bend your angel's eyes to the strangers in paradise and tell us that we
makes sense. Tony Bennett and Andre Bocelli. It's like our mind, stranger in paradise if we don't have the mind working for us. Among the many facets of ancient knowledge to be rediscovered and reinterpreted during the Renaissance period was the method used in classical antiquity for improving memory. Got your attention. Got my attention. This interesting mnemonic technique was closely associated with Hermeticism, and was not only extremely useful, but had overtones of the divine, of cosmic relevance, and of striving for perfection. In Scotland, fellow crafts were not admitted to the Freemason's Lodge without proof of memory and art of craft. Thus, proficiency in mnemonic technique was regarded as an essential part of the Freemason's skill, just as it is today. We just don't point it out. Persons obliged habitually to speak or perform in public, like actors, orators, and politicians, musicians, needed to develop methods of memorizing a vast range of material. It may startle some to learn that Greco-Roman mnemonic methods employed works of architecture, not mere buildings, in which the interiors were organized, ordered, and sufficiently complex. That is, where geometry and mathematics were used as the basis for their arrangement, as vehicles for the technique. Dr. Francis Yates devoted a whole book to what is known as the art of memory, so only the barest outline is possible here. You should be referred to Dr. Yates' work for a clear and comprehensive exposition if you're looking for that. Yates. The method used involved the detailed and careful study of a large building with architectural pretensions. The student would note the plan, the disposition of rooms, features, sculptures, finishes, and detail, and would commit these to memory, perhaps only after several visits. So you actually go there. And what men often would use is the cathedral. Anyway, naturally, this process involved a journey through the building, so the rooms, spaces, compartments, and so on were visited and viewed in a definite and logical order, involving a progression or route, a profoundly Masonic idea, as we will see. When memorizing a text, a play, a speech, or a sequence of facts or arguments, the student had to remember the route through the building so that the rooms, with their features, became associated with key elements in the text, with concepts, with faces, or even with specific words or phrases. The order of the images retained in the memory obviously had to correspond with the order of the contents of the speech. And the remembered images then had a triggering mechanism to release associations with thoughts, ideas, words, and abstractions. Such a technique allowed great scope of detailed personal observation, permitting tailor-made memory routes tuned to personal taste and convenience. Relationships between images and, of course, type of image, places, and content might be extremely obscure to all except the person involved in the exercise. During the playback, the student proceeded in his mind through the building complex, permitting each room, corridor, space, architectural detail, material, or color to prompt an association whereby the desired phrase could be triggered. Skilled perambulators through building groups as organized and as vast as Roman Thermae apparently could associate almost every word of a speech with the images of the sequence of the rote, and prodigious examples of the success of the method were claimed. Clearly, such a mnemonic technique could encourage associations, abstractions, and identification by symbol and attribute in a built environment lavishly decorated and embellished with architectural adornment and statuary that themselves were derived from a sophisticated vocabulary and fully developed language of literate design. The point is that the technique would work with classical architecture or perhaps with Gothic, but it would stand little chance of success with some of the more feeble products of the last 60 years or so, most of which hardly rate as architecture at all. You know, big flat surfaces, you know, this industrial kind of view of the world, maximizing the most space at the cheapest cost. No architecture, no design, no aesthetic. Get me started. Has that gone on in your lodge rooms? Well, largely it has, with maybe the odd distinguishing feature, but sadly, it doesn't go beyond that because the embracing architecture doesn't happen. And those that do don't seem to be able to create or to persuade. The art of memory could also involve elaborate symbols or emblems which are familiar throughout the ancient world, notably in the Roman Empire. Just as the deities of antiquity had attributes which helped to identify them and jog the memory concerning their activities and powers or specializations, so Christian iconography absorbed much that already existed. Norman Douglas's crack that Christianity was partly a quaint Alexandrian tutti-frutti could not be far off the mark in this respect. Christian saints were depicted with virtues, instruments of martyrdom, and so on, in order that they could be identified and contemplation based on memory of their deeds encouraged. St. Catherine with her wheel, St. Lawrence with his gridiron, and St. Andrew with his saltire cross are but three obvious examples. It is perhaps worth noting en passant that most saints' days record the day of martyrdom, of physical death in Christian belief, though this death is a true birth, for saints are reborn by martyrdom and enter eternal life among the blessed. The Masonic idea of death and a new life on initiation is a parallel, and both ideas go back to the beginning of time, but owe much to the developed ideas of death and rebirth in antiquity. A medieval cathedral with its labyrinths, many statues, thousands of carvings, and iconography served also as a temple of memory, reminding the pilgrim of the Temple of Solomon. Biblical stories of the deeds of saints and a formula for prayer and devotion, a point that goes a long way to explaining the extraordinary complexity of such buildings with their labyrinths, color schemes, and elaborate imagery. Mnemonic method involving perambulation through a sequence of spaces in which architectural features would be memorized was developed further by placing imaginary images or details on parts of the room as an aid to memory. There were many variations using similar techniques that could be used to suit individual tastes and requirements. This art of memory was revived during the Renaissance period and called artificial memory. Science or art of mnemonics or system of mnemonic devices was discussed in a number of Renaissance texts, including Petrus Ravenna's Phonix, the art of memory, and R. Copeland's The Art of Memory, that otherwise is called the Phoenix. Cowley in 1647 on his mistress spoke of her parts becoming to him a kind of art of memory, which might be a more agreeable method to adopt by those of less architectural turns of mind, while Hoyle in 1747 in his short treatise on the game of whist advised mnemonic methods to assist in the game in the added parts entitled an artificial memory, or an easy method of assisting the memory of those that play at the game. So the art of memory was a well-known and ancient technique that was revived during the Renaissance period as part of a general rediscovery of antiquity, and was embraced by many groups in search of esoteric knowledge using elaborate symbols and emblems, charts, frontispieces, and the like. The phoenix as a symbol of the art of memory is not an unfamiliar motif, and was used by the Templars to denote resurrection or continuity. Considerations of architecture were essential elements of the Neoplatonic themes of the Renaissance period, notably aspects of Hermeticism and the rediscovery of classical memory techniques. The art of memory, as a so-called occult art, became an important element of European intellectual life. One Guido Camillo is credited with the invention of a memory theater based on Vitruvian principles with biblical, especially Solomonic, conditions. He made objects designed to jog the memory, which he set in memory places. Not only could memory techniques be improved, Camillo claimed, but his system was supposed to be able to control the forces within the firmament itself by using the pattern of the stars and the signs of the zodiac in a wider universal theater of memory. How wonderful. Wow. Bruno also worked on methods of memory and argued that his techniques could help to reveal ancient Egyptian knowledge, enabling man to achieve union with the divine. Alexander Dickson, a Scot and follower of Bruno, published in 1584 a work based on Bruno's ideas in which antique techniques of memory were given overt Egypto-Hermetic settings. Dickson later used places and images and buildings in groups of 10, joined by visual associations, to enable them to be memorized in the correct sequence. If all this business about mystic numbers, signs of the zodiac, and revelations of ancient knowledge sounds fishy to us, we must remember that there are plenty of people around today who consult astrologers, look for signs, and put faith in numbers some 3 centuries after Newtonian enlightenment. Do I ever buy a lottery ticket? Yes. The age of the alchemical magus, of the Faustian seeker, of the wanderer. Oh, get out your tarot cards, eh? Did not have the benefit or otherwise of Newtonian physics and all that came after it. But it did have something else that perhaps recognized the importance of spiritual and measurable ecstatic values. It is suggested by Dr. David Stevenson that Bruno's influence may have introduced Hermetic ideas of memory into the mason craft in Scotland by 1599 through Bruno's disciple Alexander Dickson and William Skaw, the master of the works to the Scottish crown. Skaw was who insisted that masons should be thoroughly tested in the art of memory, for the latter was of particular interest to Freemasons. Memory. It was, after all, based on the idea of studying a large and complex building, and it was recognized as giving new powers by developing pneumatic skills for acquiring knowledge and storing facts by allusions. Dr. Yeats saw the connection between the art of memory, using architecture in the search for wisdom, and Freemasonry. She went so far as to suggest that the Renaissance occult art of memory was the source of a Hermetic and mystical movement, which used the imagery, legendary, or speculative elements of the architecture of memory as vehicles for teaching moral and mystical ideas directed towards and from the great architect of the universe. Dr. Stevenson has shown that the warden of the Lodge of Kilwenning in 1599 was ordered to test every entered apprentice and fellow craft in the art and science of memory, and that punishments were to be instituted for those who lost points. Masters most perfect in the art of memory were to test other masons in aspects of the art, craft, science, and ancient memory. Thus, it is clear from what are known as the Second Ska Statutes that Hermetic Renaissance ideas were introduced to the craft, indeed almost imposed by the master of the works himself, and that there are links between Ska, Dixon, and Bruno, as Dr. Stevenson has demonstrated. It is also clear that ideas concerning mystical enlightenment through an ancient technique not only developed aspects of Masonic custom, but influenced the iconography of the craft. These points comprise significant parts of the history of Freemasonry, linking Hermetic strands of ancient Egyptian wisdom with the Mason craft. The Enlightenment enthusiasm for Egyptian architecture and mysteries before the scientific surveys of Egyptian buildings thus makes much more sense. The Hermetic ideas permeated Scotland, and Scotland was the source of much later Masonic ceremonial. It is in Scotland, too, that we find tangible and visible evidence of how Renaissance themes had penetrated in that country. That evidence is so startling and so strange that it cannot be dismissed as artistic license or as mere chance. Yeah? So, do you have the idea? It's a bit interesting, isn't it? To think about using architecture, but to think about you'll have to sit back and think about the connection with Hermeticism. That suggests that we already know what that means. Oh, we don't have to. It's not going to embarrass us because we're close friends to admit that we don't necessarily understand all of that. Now, there may be somebody that understands a part of it, but to say that, you know, somebody has made his life's work at studying Hermeticism, I often think that I'm skimming the surface every time that it's brought up. Every single time that it's brought up. So I have difficulty suggesting that I can really add to this part of the conversation because it's a bit obscure. Maybe we need to move this whole discussion a bit sideways and just refresh our minds with a notion of what Hermeticism is. So for upcoming show, we'll get into that, just a little encapsulated version. You can do the in-depth study and work yourself, of course, in your own way. This may not be something that's really significant to one and all, but what we're hearing and what we're seeing in this material is our connections, strangers in paradise, eh? Coming together. So we see how, and we're looking at 16th century. I know not every one of us is going to be a consummate Masonic scholar, but I think if you know an esoteric portion and you know it very well, and you've researched it as far back as you can, so that what your opinion, what you validate your opinion by what we will assume are bona fide fact, you know, irrefutable fact, then we can pass that knowledge on collectively to the next generations. don't think that we all have to know everything. We're not necessarily polyglots. There are some, but not necessarily everybody. So bring your attention to a part that fascinates you. Own it. Own it. Explore every aspect of that thin thread, because you and I never know in the larger tapestry what role that thread will perform. Learn it well, then we can pass it on. I guess I'm a bit obvious when I talk so much about ancient charges. But I think they were important, because that sets the temperament for, that passes on this collective temperament that we want, that we seek. What we do with it, the experience, that personality, that's unique to our histories, our Masonic histories. What would be more interesting for me than wishing somebody a productive Masonic journey is to wish somebody a productive and enlightened Masonic history. Truly, journey, I just don't get. History, yeah. So we'll come back to this, huh? Yeah, I think, if you don't mind. And we'll do it in a week, I think. I think that'll be interesting. We'll come back. You know, we can go over this again. If you have questions, send your email in to me at masoniccompanion@gmail.com. If you have questions, I'll answer all the easy ones, of course. No, I'll give serious consideration to any of the questions that you send. And this is again, simple, masoniccompanion@gmail.com. I like that. I thought that worked for mnemonics. And remember, there were, in the day, in Victorian parlor, there were times when people would compete, recite entire chapters of the Bible. This was done as a parlor trick. Demonstration of memory, it helps to organize our understanding of what memory is, and how it works. It's not the same for every person. It's not a competition. It depends. There's so many variables, and that information is in there. It's what we're talking about are retrieval processes. This idea of forgetting, we know that that's, if the idea is that what was there is now gone, well, we know better than that. There's all these, our brain stores information and experience. Even though, you know, that notion that some of us read about and accepted, Noam Chomsky, the linguist who started us thinking and realizing that when babies are born, they're born with certain linguistic capabilities. Well, now, we're talking about this new tools used by neurology. We're finding the inclination is that babies learn from experience. Yeah, sort of sets back people like me that always thought, how do they pick up a meaning of our language before they're verbal? And I do still think that does occur, that babies understand more than they can speak, because they don't have control over their larynx, so they don't have control to be able to speak. That takes other muscles and coordination and other experiences that are a bit obscure. Yeah. So. And now I'm walking through, and now I have to find a building. Some suggestions on the buildings that will help with the mnemonics are museums. buildings with different multiple rooms. And when you're in the room, you think about what's in there. So you can even do, I suppose, I don't know if you could do this on the internet. You know, you can take a virtual walk through the Louvre or the Hermitage and, you know, different art galleries and things. But if you can go to a place, you know, cathedral is wonderful because of the iconography. What does this, you know, the Stations of the Cross, what does this represent in terms of the work that you're trying to remember? And then you just remember the next sequence in the progression of the stations and the next portion of the work and the next portion of the work and the next portion. So people were able to do this in galleries and rooms and buildings. So literally, if you have a room with different things around it, I'm looking here at a native spirit mask. So what does that spirit mask, you know, what do I want to associate with that spirit mask? Next to the left of it, a barometer, and in front of that, a computer screen, and to the right of it, something that I have no idea. I can't explain. It's a clock. I have no idea what that measures. Anyway, I'll rely on you to help me get by. The things that I just don't understand that I can admit anymore. So, that was pretty good. We were carrying on about looking at Freemasonry in ways that may not have heard about in Lodges, particularly the idea of enlightenment. Now, I'm going to talk to you about the elements. You know, we're thinking that rational thought was sort of a latter-day kind of an event. Well, not so much. Like everything else, there's evidence that the ancients were wise beyond what could be understood at the time. Sort of that prescient. How did they know these things? How did they know about molecules back in ancient Greece? How did they know this? You know, to just hear like this. Timon of Athens, 1607, says, "'Tis not enough to help the feeble up, but to support him after. I wonder men dare trust themselves with men. Like madness is the glory of this life. Men shut their doors against the setting sun. You fools of fortune, trench your friends, time flies. We have seen better days. Never learned the icy precepts of respect. The moon's an errant thief, and her pale fire she snatches from the sun." We're living it right here under a full moon, I think. Yeah. Let's type it. Timon. Or Timon. So, as Shakespeare says, "And it is great to do that thing that ends all other deeds, which shackles accidents and bolts up change." "Finish, good lady, the bright day is done, and we are for the dark." That's from Act 5 of Antony and Cleopatra. Yeah. Margaret Jacob. Let's dust off Margaret again. The wonderful, engaging, enthusiastic academic. A scholar who has, you know, if you walk around dragging yourself around and trying to be smug, well, you're sort of missing the point. These are folks that aren't impressed by that. And that kind of behavior, that kind of posturing is so transparent to people that read that type of thing. So don't do that. My suggestion to those of you who are self-aware, don't do that. Don't do that. That makes me laugh and think about I won't say who she was, but a lady of some renown encountered Winston Churchill one evening. "Mr. Churchill, you're disgustingly drunk." And he stepped back. He said, "Madam, you are disgustingly ugly. And in the morning, I shall be sober, but you will still be disgustingly ugly." I know, I'm sorry. I'll burn for that one, I know. But hey, the guy said it. It wasn't perfect. So, I like that. I don't like people that pretend. I like people that I can trust, that have foibles and shortcomings. Ah, let's see what the Dutch Freemasons reveal to us. Eh? And here we get to sit back and sample another cultural menu here. As we feast on this, or if you're thinking about your laboratory, this is a different set of chemicals that have come to us from the Netherlands, a source of enormous trade and connectivity. So many people came. It was so accessible. And, of course, it was trampled on and torn apart by, you know, every bloody army. Just happened is the situation of the geography, you know. So we'll just send our army over there. Well, they've been doing that for, you know, we've been doing that for thousands of years. So here we remember we were talking last week about Carrasco, the lodge. And the Dutch Masons, remember? And the contacts of Les Bien-Aimés. Remember the worshipful master wanted to legitimize the lodge. And this is where the lodges in Holland formed a legitimacy based on Masonic constitution. So for the very first time we're bearing witness to constitutional authority beyond government. Oh, you Masonic upstarts. Don't think so little of this. Please don't think that this is lost to Freemasonry today, not just because you haven't been exposed to it. Now you are. Masonic history will be enriched, I hope, and we'll talk about it. Don't have to do this alone. But the change, that little spark of enlightenment, that experience, that awareness is within you. Nobody else can tell. We don't have a particular type of behavior that shows that we've reached enlightenment, but we all understand when a man has achieved that. And what is it? Is he stoic? The most delightful, reverent example that comes to my mind today, of course, is the good fortune of us to live in a world that has the Dalai Lama with us. That infectious sense of humor, that smile, that sense of knowing. There's a man who believes that he believes in incarnation, and he visits and he's guided by past spirits, past people who have gone on. What does he know? And it's easier, of course, to mock what we don't know. I find, as I get, again, I'm a little older this week than I was last week. I'm not laughing quite as much as I ever did before. I laugh at funny things. I laugh with friends. But the things I don't know, they're making me stop. And it's a bit embarrassing when people around me are sort of cutting up. And I just am thinking, gee, I don't get the humor in it. But I just realize that I just don't understand what it is that's going on. Not much fun in that, I guess, for other people. Although the Dutch merchants met in the Curaçao Lodge with some English brothers, their legitimacy was sought from The Hague, now that a Grand Lodge existed there, and not from the Grand Lodge in either Paris or London. As the letter of their Amsterdam brothers makes clear, a new lodge, however distant, could be established at will, with brothers filling the offices by a simple election. But the legitimacy of the lodge, a matter separate from its creation, required recognition from other constitutionally established lodges. So we're seeing a reference to clandestine lodges. Perfectly free, go and elect your offices perfectly. Go ahead and do that. But the legitimacy is through constitutionally established lodges. It is worth noting, if only in passing, that the establishment of the lodge in Carasso was not without controversy. The description of that process makes reference to the slander, quote, slander through sex, that it threatened to embitter the opening of our temple of decent amusement. As we saw earlier in the Lodge of Nimeguen, the slander suggests the possibility of the accusations of sodomy against the exclusively male fraternity. The topic must await, we'll talk about that later, but the reference once again reminds us of the range of social tensions that Masonic fraternity could arouse. Dr. Andreas Onofors brought that to our attention in a very powerful way at the very first Sankey lecture, didn't he? Do you remember the symbols that he cited that were collectively associated in the public's mind that prompted fear? The square and compasses were amongst them. And here we see this very unfortunate. To prevent these tensions spilling into the lodge in Amsterdam, as elsewhere, new brothers were admitted by election. But with an overwhelming majority near unanimity required for admission, this process was profoundly social and personal. Candidates for admission were invariably described as honest men, possessing the character and the morals and the discretion of which there can be no reproach, such that they may aspire to the advantage of being initiated into our mysteries. Men had to be local or well known by brothers who were local. Men could be and were rejected. As the orator said, the principles of our institution, the philanthropy, the charity, and the sweet primitive equality of all men, which is the foundation of our art, is what we seek to reestablish in our hearts as well as in our assemblies. In the new public space which the lodge created, brothers promised unanimously to correct our conduct. The public outside the lodge judges morality only by appearances. The world is a place of prejudice and caprice. But Freemasons know that morality is inseparable from virtue, and the good company of my brothers is always the necessary condition for morality. You dictate in detail the duties of society. It's absolutely true, I should say, in my experience. It's wonderful. Morality and virtue are inseparable from social experience. They are social experience. Ouch. The author here is giving somebody like me a bit of stick here. That means just I can't pretend, turn a blind eye, go along with whatever's happening around me. Ouch. There's a price for being virtuous, is what she's saying. I know. Morality and virtue are inseparable from social experience. They are social experience. As Schroeder put it, the external displays of civility, so important in the lodges, reveal the internal civility of a man. Oh, now she's getting personal. Charity is at the heart of civility. A person caring of each brother, one for the other. And the lodge permits that experience among men carefully chosen by their peers, governed strictly by the rules of the order, sequestered from the world, obedient to their masters as friends, citizens, and as brothers. In the sacred temple of Freemasonry, brothers will find a true liberty, a true peace. Brothers are united in order to give an example to all the world, which will see us as being in the process of making our superb edifice the high point of perfection. So, what we've seen in the outside. They will stand firm against the unfounded slander of the blind common people. Yeah, I would say that. Such important work required brothers carefully chosen, with similar values and mores.
There's the rub, isn't it? How do we know that the fellow has similar values? That's difficult. Or is it? Only near unanimity would suffice. Other matters required only a simple majority of voting brothers. As the household rules of Le Bien Ami make clear, once admitted, brothers were required to be punctual, and attendance was rigorously demanded, with fines imposed for absence. When the fines proved controversial and threatened to impair the harmony of the lodge, they were removed, and an annual fee of 24 guilders was put in their place. Ha! The fee wasn't a fundraiser, it was in lieu of fines. Well. Eventually, in place of a system of black and white beans used for voting by ballot, a system using coins, probably imitative of the practices of the old local guilds, was adopted. Moreover, in at least one other lodge, fines were also imposed for immoral behavior, excessive card playing, sleeping away from home in places of ill repute, and lingering at the lodge after it was formally closed. The beneficiaries of immorality were to be the poor into whose box the fines were put. Sometime in the 19th century, Dutch Freemasons went through their old records and came up with a list of men who had been excluded from all the 18th century lodges and the reasons for their exclusion. Tantalizingly brief, they include outrageous behavior and unruly behavior, as well as dereliction in dues payment. Dozens of men were banned or excluded from the 1750s to the 1790s. By the late 1750s, the legitimacy as well as the discipline of Le Bien Ami was firmly established. In addition, Dutch Freemasonry in general had begun to assume a national identity. Its grandmaster could now speak of Le Frère député de la respective cousin à Saint l'Assemblée nationale tenue à La Haye. At these national assemblies held in The Hague, the ceremonies placed brothers standing in rows, first symbolizing the Staten van Holland, that is, the States of Holland, the body that had once condemned the order, and which could be described as the legislative body of the province. Behind them stood other brothers, described as representing the national grandmaster. Finally, standing in back of them were the officers of the lodge, visitors, and all the other brothers, all of whom then joined in the communal singing that was so much part of Masonic ritual. Isn't that interesting? This identity was clearly civic, governmental, and by the late 1750s, increasingly Dutch and national. By that time, it was as if the national proletity could be symbolically located within the lodges. Any doubts we may have about this nationalistic meaning are dispelled by the fact that in 1758, English brothers who want to establish their own lodge in Amsterdam appeal to rebellious Le Bien Ami, not to the Grand Lodge in The Hague, for the recognition that brought legitimacy with it. Both dissident groups, for very different reasons, are having a dispute with the National Grand Lodge in The Hague. But the English brothers are seceding from the Dutch Grand Lodge because they do not share its national political identity. Here's a letter from an English Freemason replete with nationalist and rebellious sentiments, and it's an extraordinary document. It's written, let us say, in Boston in 1777, when the Massachusetts lodges did secede from the Grand Lodge, the London Grand Lodge. We would explain it by reference to a new and emerging national identity. Here it is, January 13th, 1758. It's not very long. Right Worshipful and Honorful Lodge, Le Bien Ami. We, George Smith, A.B. and lecturer in mathematics, Grandmaster of Masons by a constitution granted solely onto us by James Bridges, Duke of Shandos, Earl of Carnarvon, of the ancient and honorable fraternity of free and accepted Masons. Being willing and desirous, together with several other worthy brothers, to have a communication and correspondence with your Right Worshipful Lodge, further craving your assistance and advice in regard to a derision and misunderstanding between the English and Dutch members of our lodge, the purport of which is, we, the English, provided with the above constitution, actually will not be subservient to either the laws or demands of the present national Grand Master. Neither are we willing to receive a national constitution or be dependent therefrom, which is what our Dutch brothers insist upon. We therefore think proper to establish a lodge entirely English by the name of Concordia, and shall therefore desire, as by these present admittance into your Right Worshipful Fraternity of Masons, and from thence to be favored with your Right Worshipfuls, wardens, officers, and members of vice for the promotion and propagation of Masonry and the craft in general. We therefore salute you by 3 times 3. In these records, we have come upon the private socialization of middling men of considerable literacy and sophistication, who define themselves as adherents of a constitution and laws which permit them to defy other, also self-defined, legitimate authorities. George Smith, for instance, was a teacher of mathematics and Newtonian mechanics. The defiant tone of Smith's letter reveals his own sense of English national identity, one that is now in reaction to the formation of the Grand Lodge of the Netherlands in 1756. Like the records of Les Bien Amis, the letter reveals the obsessive Masonic concern for the legitimacy of these private polities, a status achieved only through a social act by the recognition accorded a lodge by other lodges. But what legitimacy was to be denied and recognition withheld? While the brothers of Les Bien-Aimés refused to follow Smith in his rebellion, they had constitutional and procedural problems of their own with the new National Grand Lodge. There. We'll pick this up with the founding of the first official Dutch Lodge in 1735. So we'll come back to this. And I think we see that the development of a constitutional societies does have a bearing on us. Yeah. Of course it does, because that's what we are. We function according to a constitution. Again, it makes us more aware, even when you're thinking about dues, we probably think of them as paying the bills, but these fellows are going beyond that. This was a source. The fines that we paid were a source of a donation to the poor. I guess it's a bit odd, a bit uncomfortable that we don't do that with through lodge meetings anymore, do we? Or do we? Some lodges do. Still do. So let's look at this again and see where we go. And see if we can't pick it up. We'll talk a bit about the history of the world, but I promise you we're going to get into, I'll be explaining some of the connections with what, in my mind, has to do with the civilization of Egypt, and the connections that I think are kind of, it's uncanny. Maybe I'm making more of it in my mind than is really there, you know. Maybe I'm, you know, sort of sinking into the notion of the Kabbalah and to Hermeticism more than I'm comfortable to admit. But the geography of and seasonal cycles in Egypt along the Nile explain a great deal, a great deal. I've done a talk on this some time ago at, I think it was a lodge in Owen Sound. It's not really important which one. But I remember doing that, and yeah, I think the complication was that, you know, it's, I realized that you have to be in a mood or of a mind to talk about those types of things. And my mistake was presuming that. So won't do that. You can turn all of this off. Huh? But before we do that, I want to just wrap this up a little bit by talking about, we'll start to go through history here, the history of six glasses. You okay with that? A renewal, it's a delightful read, and I think you're gonna really enjoy it. We're gonna start off with the beginning, eh? And I'll talk to you about fermentation and civilization, and the Stone Age brew. Thank goodness, you know, if you're thinking about tipping a pint today, for whatever reason, there must be a saint day, you know. I'll see what I'm trying to just see what the saint is of today. For February 15th, Saint Walfrid. He was born in Pisa and became saint of the day. That's the 16th. I'm trying to. This is what the 15th today. Saint. Let's see, Saint Daniel, Saint Daniel, there you go. Died in 309. He and four companions, Elias, Esaias, Jeremy, and Samuel, were Egyptians who visited Christians condemned to work in the mines of Cilicia during Maximus' persecution to comfort them. Apprehended at the gates of Caesarea Palestine, they were brought before the governor, Firmilian, and accused of being Christians. They were all tortured and then beheaded. Oh, lovely. And when Porphyry, a servant of St. Pephilus, demanded that the bodies be buried, he was tortured and then burned to death. When it was found, he was a Christian. Seleucus witnessed his death and applauded his consistency in the face of his terrible death, whereupon he was arrested by the soldiers involved in the execution, brought before the governor, and was beheaded. This Firmilian, the governor, was a nasty creature. Man, get some probiotics going in that bowel. Holy goodness. So this is the feast day for St. Daniel. So tip a pint, recognize this, you know, if you're inclined to that type of thing. And if you're not, well, so be it. You can go off and celebrate. It's also the day, feast day for Saint Agnes. So you can, you know, have your way with that. The Benedictine abbot, of course, of Saint Gabriel's. He died in 1100. There, it's a little newer for those that like that type of thing. Well, ready to crack into a little bit of this good beer in Mesopotamia. You know, this is a good thing. The humans have migrated out of area. And we're going to be wrapping this up soon. Oh, my goodness. Look at this. We don't have a whole lot of time. We'll do what we can. The humans who migrated out of Africa started around 50,000 years ago, traveling in small nomadic bands, perhaps 30 strong, and lived in caves and huts or skin tents. And they hunted game and caught fish and shellfish and gathered edible plants, moving from one temporary camp to another to, you know, we're going to eat. So pick up, and we've hunted this area out. We've picked up all the berries and nuts. We have to go somewhere else, of course. And their tools included bows and arrows, fish hooks, and needles. So this is a fairly sophisticated period in time. But then, starting around 12,000 years ago, a remarkable shift occurred. Humans in the Near East abandoned the old hunter-gatherer lifestyle of the Paleolithic period, that's the old Stone Age, right? And began to take up farming instead, settling down in valleys, villages, which eventually grew to become the world's first cities. They also developed new technologies, including pottery, wheeled vehicles, and writing. Ever since the emergence of anatomically modern humans, or Homo sapiens sapiens, in Africa around 100, well, we can tell this is outdated, but be generous here, 150,000 years ago, water had been humankind's basic drink, a fluid of primordial importance. It makes up two-thirds of the human body, and no life on Earth can exist without it. And by the way, 85% of your energy goes to supporting the workings of your brain. Two-thirds of us is water, 85%. The rest, the other 15%, is all it takes for the rest of the function. Your brain getting a little more important, yeah. But with the switch from the hunter-gatherer lifestyle to a more settled way of life, humans came to rely on a new beverage derived from barley and wheat. Mm-mm. The cereal grains, which were the first plant. Doesn't that make me sound bright? Sorry. You've done this too. Come on now. If you're not tipping a pint, if it's not for medical reasons, I don't trust you. Hang up. Go away. This drink became so central to social, religious, and economic life and was the staple beverage of the earliest civilizations. This drink first helped humanity along the path to the modern world. Beer. Exactly when the first beer was brewed is not known. There was almost certainly no beer before 10,000 BC, but it was widespread in the Near East by 4,000 BC, when it appears in a pictogram from Mesopotamia, a region that corresponds to modern-day Iraq, depicting two figures drinking beer through reed straws from a large pottery jar. Ancient beer had grains, chaff, and other debris floating on its surface, so a straw was necessary to avoid swallowing them. Yeah, good idea. Yeah, that makes perfect sense. Since the first, it's like, we do that with some sparkling wines. You drink a piccolo. When you go to the liquor store and get a piccolo, you drink that through a straw. Yeah, very nice, very civilized. The earliest written documents can shed no direct light on beer's origins, but what is clear, however, is that the rise of beer was closely associated with the domestication of the central grains from which it was made and the adoption of farming. It came into existence during a turbulent period in human history that witnessed the switch from a nomadic to a settled lifestyle, followed by a sudden increase in social complexity, manifested most strikingly in the emergence of cities. Beer is a liquid relic from human prehistory, and its origins are closely entwined with the origins of civilization itself. Beer was not invented, but discovered. Its discovery was inevitable once the gathering of wild grains became widespread after the end of the last ice age. That was only 10,000 years BC. Think about that. It's like, what, 50,000 years ago was the end of the last ice age. Feeling comfortable now, and it was a region referred to in the world as the Fertile Crescent. This area stretches from modern-day Egypt up the Mediterranean coast to the southeast corner of Turkey, and then down again to the border between Iraq and Iran. It is so named because of a happy accident of geography. When the Ice Age ended, the uplands of the region provided an ideal environment for wild sheep and goats, cattle and pigs, and some areas for dense stands of wild wheat and barley. This meant the Fertile Crescent provided unusually rich pickings for roving bands of human hunter-gatherers. They not only hunted animals and gathered edible plants, but collected the abundant cereal grains growing wild in the region. Such grains provided an unexciting but reliable source of food. Although unsuitable for consumption when raw, they can be made edible by roughly pounding or crushing them and then soaking them in water. Initially, they were probably just mixed into soup. A variety of ingredients, such as fish and nuts and berries, would have been mixed with water in a plastered or bitumen-lined basket. Stones heated on a fire were then dropped in using a forked stick. grains contain tiny granules of starch, and then placed in hot water, they absorb moisture and then burst, releasing the starch into the soup and thickening it considerably. Old recipes for beer. Central grains, it was soon discovered, had another unusual property. Unlike other foodstuffs, they could be stored for consumption months or even years later if kept dry and safe. When no other foodstuffs were available to make soup, they could be used on their own to make a thick porridge or a thin broth or gruel. This discovery led to the development of tools and techniques to collect, process, and store grain. It involved quite a lot of effort, but proved a way to guard against the possibility of future food shortages. Throughout the Fertile Crescent, there is an archaeological evidence that around 10,000 BC, flinted edges and bladed sickles for harvesting grains, cereal grains, and woven baskets for carrying them, and stone hearths for drying them, underground pits for storing them, and grindstones for processing them. Although hunter-gatherers had previously led semi-settled rather than entirely nomadic lives, moving between a number of temporary or seasonal shelters, the ability to store cereal grains began to encourage people to stay in one place. An experiment carried out in the 1960s showed why. An archaeologist used a flint-bladed sickle to see how efficiently a prehistoric family could have harvested wild grains which still grow in some parts of Turkey. In 1 hour, he gathered more than 2 pounds of grain, which suggested that a family that worked 8 hours for 3 weeks could have been able to gather enough to provide each family member with a pound of grain a day for a year. But this would have meant staying near the stands of wild grains to ensure the family did not miss the most suitable time to harvest them. And having gathered a large quantity of grain, it would be reluctant to leave it unguarded. The result was the first permanent settlement, such as those established in the east coast of the Mediterranean around 10,000 BC. They consisted of simple round huts with roofs supported by wooden posts and floors sunk up to a yard into the ground. These huts usually had a hearth and a floor paved with stones and were 4 or 5 yards in diameter. A typical village consisted of around 50 huts, supporting a community of 200 to 300 people. Although the residents of these such villages continued to hunt wild animals like gazelle and deer and boar, there's evidence that suggested they had mainly a plant-based diet, acorns, lentils, chickpeas, and cereals, which at this stage were still gathered in the wild rather than cultivated deliberately. Cereal grains, which started off as a relatively unimportant foodstuff, took on greater importance following the discovery that they had two much more unusual properties. The first was that grain soaked in water so that it starts to sprout tastes sweet. It was difficult to make storage pits perfectly watertight, so this property would have become apparent as soon as humans first began to store grain. The cause of the sweetness is now understood. Moistened grain produces diastase enzymes, which convert starch into maltose sugar or malt. This process occurs in all cereal grains, but barley produces by far the most diastase enzymes and hence the most maltose sugar. At a time when few other grain sources of sugar were available, the sweetness of this malted grain would have been highly valued, prompting the development of deliberate malting techniques in which the grain was first soaked and then dried. The second discovery was even more momentous, and this gave rise to the sports of football and hockey. I'm pretty sure. Gruel that was left standing around for a few days underwent a mysterious transformation, particularly if it had been made with malted grain. It became slightly fizzy and pleasantly intoxicating as the action of wild yeast from the air fermented the sugar in the gruel into alcohol. The gruel, in short, turned into beer. Even so, beer was not necessarily the first form of alcohol to pass human lips. At the time of beer's discovery, alcohol from the accidental fermentation of fruit juice to make wine or water and honey to make mead would have occurred naturally in small quantities as people tried to store fruit and honey. But fruit is seasonal and perishes easily, and wild honey was only available in limited quantities, while wine nor mead could be stored for very long without pottery, which did not emerge until around 6000 BC. Beer, on the other hand, could be made from cereal crops, which were abundant and could be easily stored, allowing beer to be made reliably and in quantity when needed. Long before pottery was available, it could have been brewed in pitch-lined baskets, leather bags, or animal stomachs, hollowed-out trees, large shells, or stone vessels. Our ancient brethren were resourceful. Shells were used for cooking as recently as the 19th century in the Amazon basin. And saati, a traditional beer made in Finland, is still brewed in hollowed-out trees today. Let's try that, eh? Once the crucial discovery of beer had been made, its quality was improved through trial and error. The more malted grain there is in the original gruel and the longer it is left to ferment, the stronger the beer. More malt means more sugar, and a longer fermentation means more of the sugar is turned into alcohol. Thoroughly cooking the gruel also contributes to the beer's strength. The malting process converts only around 15% of the starch found in barley grains into sugar. But when malted barley is mixed with water and brought to the boil, other starch-converting enzymes, which become active at higher temperatures, turn more of the starch into sugar. So there's even more sugar for the yeast to transform into alcohol. Ancient brewers also noticed that using the same container repeatedly for brewing produced more reliable results. Later, historical records from Egypt and Mesopotamia showed that brewers always carried their own mash tubs around with them. And one Mesopotamian myth refers to containers which make the beer good. Repeated use of the same mash tub promoted successful fermentation because yeast cultures took up residence in the container's cracks and crevices, so that there was no need to rely on the more capricious wild yeast. Finally, adding berries, honey, spices, herbs, and other flavorings to the gruel altered the taste of the resulting beer in various ways. Over the next few thousand years, people discovered how to make a variety of beers of different strengths and flavors for different occasions. Later Egyptian records mention at least 17 kinds of beer, some of them referred to in poetic terms that sound to modern ears almost like advertising slogans. Different beers were known as the beautiful and good, the heavenly, the joy bringer, the addition to the meal, the plentiful, and the fermented. Beers used in religious ceremonies also had special names. Similarly, early written references to beer from different kinds included fresh beer, fresh dark beer, strong, red-brown beer, light beer, and pressed beer. Red-brown beer was a dark beer made using extra malt, while pressed beer was a weaker, more watery a brew that contained less grain. The red-brown would be like a Guinness. Mesopotamian brewers could also control the taste and color of their beer by adding different amounts of bapir, or beer bread. To make bapir, sprouted barley was shaped into lumps, like small loaves, which were baked twice to produce a dark brown, crunchy, unleavened bread that could be stored for years before being crumbled into the brewer's vat. Records indicate that bapir was kept in government storehouses and was only eaten during food shortages. It was not so much a foodstuff as a convenient way to store the raw material for making beer. The Mesopotamian use of bread in brewing has led to much debate amongst archaeologists, some of whom have suggested that bread must therefore be an offshoot of beer making, while others have argued that bread came first and was subsequently used as an ingredient in beer. It seems most likely, however, that both beer and bread were derived from gruel. A thick gruel could be baked in the sun or on a hot stone to make flat bread. a thin gruel could be left to ferment into beer. The two were different sides of the same coin. Bread was solid beer, beer was liquid bread. More? More, you say? Next week. That's about all I want to talk to you about. It's all the advice I need this week. I'm done. Finito. Polished. Still a work in progress. Thanks for joining me today. I'm very, very, very happy to have this time with you. I want to give you a little bit of a treat. For those who are continuing the theme of introducing music into this, I'll see you next week. In the meantime, I hope you do well. Lucille Ball said, "I'd rather regret the things I've done than regret the things I haven't done." And this is a wish that I have for you from the French philosopher Molière. A wise man is superior to any insults which can be put upon him. And the best reply to unseemly behavior is patience and moderation. I wish that for each and every one of you. Beware of false knowledge. It is more dangerous than ignorance. That's from George Bernard Shaw. I'll see you next week. Commit an act of random Masonic kindness. The most sublime is if nobody knows it's you. And we'll get together soon. Okay? I hope. Bye for now. Edda James. Done by Cindy Lauper. A dream that I